The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in, So the Buddha was a storyteller, often using metaphors and similes and stories to do his teachings. And one time I want to tell you one of the stories he told. And he says it in English, once in the past. I wonder how much that's like once upon a time. But once in the past, there was an acrobat and an acrobat's assistant. And they did their art, their performance, somehow on a bamboo pole. And the commentaries say that the acrobat would hold the bamboo pole, stick it on his forehead and balance it, and the assistant would climb up the pole and do various, you know, acrobatic tricks on the pole while he kept the balance. So the apprentice who was the one who climbed the pole had the peculiar name or the nickname Frying Pan. And I don't know why, but I like the English, you know, little saying, you know, you go into the frying pan means it's, you know, it's getting kind of difficult, challenging, right? So I imagine this poor acrobat assistant climbing up this pole was, you know, a challenging thing. So it was a, you know, challenging art to have. So that once the acrobat said to the assistant, you climb up my shoulders to go up on the pole. And if you watch over me while we're doing our trick, and I watch over you, that way we'll be safe. And we can do our show, and people will reward us with lots of money, lots of donations, you know, street performer. And so the acrobat's assistant said, no, that's not how it should be done. And she said, it should be done, I'll watch over myself, and you watch over yourself, and each of us watching over our own selves, that way we'll be safe in our performance. And the Buddha said, telling that story, he said, it's the same thing with us in the practice. He said, that's the method here. And then he goes on to say that the way, so that's, he kind of approves what the apprentice assistant said. It's kind of a nice idea, you know, to take care of yourself first. And I was reminded of the story on Friday when someone told the story of when she was trained to be a wilderness first responder. And she was taught to, you know, to go into the wilderness to find someone who's been injured. And she was taught that you don't rush up to the person who's injured and they've fallen off the cliff or something. And you take your time and you look around and study the situation first, so that you can make sure that it was safe for everybody, safe for the responder. You know, if the person's fallen on the cliff, you want to make sure there's not going to be a landslide on top of you. You're not going to help anyone then. So to first you kind of take care of yourself as the responder, make sure it's all safe, and then you step in and take care of the person. I saw that some years ago when I stopped for a fire up on Skyline. There was a little, in someone's yard up there, there was a fire. And what had happened was a big pile of branches and leaves and stuff. And the person had thrown the ashes from the coal, from the fire, into that big pile, not noticing that there was still some hot coals in it. So it was a huge pile of leaves, and there was a huge fire going up. And so I was one of the first people there, and then the fire people came right afterwards. But the owner was there with a pitchfork trying to figure out what to do, trying to break it up or something. And so the fire chief came And I was very impressed. The fire chief just kind of calmly moseyed down and looked at it. And the person, the owner, that was yelling and actually pointing the pitchfork like at the chest of the fire. You got to do something now. And the fire chief kind of looked, yeah, we'll do something. And then they did something, and they put it out. But this idea that, you know, you take your time, you stay present and mindful, you kind of see what the situation is. And then the bigger picture, and the, maybe you're a lot safer that way than rushing in and seeing it all as an emergency. I once called the fire department many years ago when I lived in Marin County, because I forget so much the details of it, but someone said, oh, there's a little fire up there. And I kind of didn't take the time to look. And so I called, and they came, and there wasn't a little fire up there. There was someone smoking a cigarette. So, you know, to this idea of, you know, rushing, you know, getting all excited. And, oh, there's an emergency. Got to take care of it right away. So the Buddha said, see, in the same way as the acrobat's assistance advice, let's take care of ourselves first, watch ourselves. How do we do that here? And here the Buddha does something a little bit sleight of hand, because he, so you listen to this. So here with us in the practice, it's just the same way. I will protect myself. Thus should the four foundations of mindfulness be practiced. So if you want to protect yourself, practice mindfulness. Check in with your body, check in with your feelings, your mind states, what's going on with you. That's the way you can be safe in the Dharma. And then protecting myself, then I'll protect you, was the apprentice said. So then Buddha said, I will protect others. How? By establishing the four foundations of mindfulness. Protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. And this is a great little saying. Protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. That there's a mutuality going on here. And this is deeply embedded in the, I think, in the Dharma teaching, this idea that we're all in it together, that we actually have a tremendous a relationship with each other, that if you really take care of yourself well, that will take care of other people. If you take care of others well, that'll take care of you. And so where that balance is, what you focus on any given time, is maybe part of the art of it. But it's not one or the other. And so I've seen many times where if someone was able to stay calm and present and attentive and kind of not lose their wisdom, not lose their cool, not lose their you know, their ability to be wise, they took care of the situation for other people much better. Whereas when someone lost their cool and got all excited, not only was it not good for them, but they more often made it more dangerous for the other people as well. And so, and here he says, by the practice of mindfulness, we make it safe for oneself and others, others and ourselves. And then he goes on to say, and how that by protecting oneself, one protects others. He's going to repeat himself here. By the pursuit, development, and cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness. In such a way, it is in such a way that by protecting oneself, one protects others. And how is it that by protecting others, one protects oneself? By patience, harmlessness, loving-kindness, and sympathy. It is in such a way that by protecting others, one protects oneself. So here, patience, harmlessness, loving-kindness, and sympathy are the ways to protect others. So it's not doing something for others. It's not like, you know, protecting them from danger, except the biggest danger you're protecting them from is yourself. If you can be patient, if you can practice harmlessness, ahimsa is the word, if you can practice loving kindness or sympathy, compassion, then certainly people are protected from you, and also the motivations that you act on are probably going to be the ones that are going to protect them in real ways in the world. You'll do things for people. You'll step forward and take care of them. I think that the idea of supporting people around us, stepping in and being their support, is something that all of us need. We live in a society now, we see more, I don't know if it's more, but certainly a lot of it, where a tremendous amount of prejudice goes on, tremendous amount of hostility, and people don't treat each other well. And sometimes because of racism, for homophobia, all kinds of things. And to be able to step forward out of harmlessness and patience and compassion, to offer protection, support for others, to be able to be kind of an ally for other people, not to let things go kind of unspoken and ignored because it doesn't affect us, but to figure out some way to step forward with those qualities to be, offer support and help, I think is something that is going to become increasingly important as some of the tensions in our society get stronger and stronger. But to do that, but only by first taking care of oneself, by being grounded and connected to your own motivations, what's going on, what your beliefs are, what's happening to you, to be grounded and centered in the four foundations of mindfulness and mindfulness practice. If you take care of yourself that way, then you will not give free rein to the kind of impulses where you harm yourself. You won't act on greed, you won't act on hate, you won't act on delusion. If you don't act on greed, hate, and delusion, then you are a person who doesn't harm other people, are more likely to act on the opposite. The opposite of greed is said to be generosity. The opposite of hate is said to be love. And the opposite of delusion is wisdom. So greed, hate, and delusion. So protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. This has been part of the rationale for, not just in Buddhism, but in what I've read, in much of Indian religions, of why it's seen so beneficial for people to go spend a serious amount of time off a, kind of away, out of society, on retreat and practicing. Because the more deeply we can take care of ourselves, the better we can come back and be support to people in our society or be an inspiration. Right after 9/11, that was probably a few days after, a couple of people here from IMC went off to sit a three-month retreat at Barre, Massachusetts, IMS. And, the country was kind of traumatized after 9/11, and the idea of, it seemed like this is the time the society needed lots of people support, lots of, someone helping, being involved. And I was concerned that they would feel that it was somehow inappropriate for them to go off into this three-month retreat, silent retreat, right after that kind of event. So I went and found them out and said, you might think this way, but in fact, this is one of the best responses that you could do to go do that, because someone, there's only hope if someone can show how to get to the bottom of our hearts to where and uproot the forces of greed, hate, and delusion that we have there. And if if other people, if we can really see that people do this work, it's an inspiration for other people. They say, oh, it's possible. I don't have to act on hate. I don't have to act on greed. I can find some way to cleanse myself of those things. So the idea that it might look like it's selfish to go off to do that kind of thing, it could be actually a very selfless thing to do, because you're doing the kind of deep, powerful work for all of us to come back and support the world around us. And I know that I've been very inspired when I was a newer practitioner by some of the people that I met who had done such things and had been transformed by it. And now they were available to the world in beautiful ways that kind of very pure ways, or generous ways, compassionate ways. So protecting, so the slogan is protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. So what do you think of this? What are your thoughts about this? Do you have any comments or questions you'd like to ask or testimonials?
I apologize because this is out of a book. It's from...
That's what I did.
Well, I'm clear then. A student of Suzuki Roshi's came to him repeatedly saying, you know, I'm trying to make cookies for my friend and I'm trying to take care of this person and that person. And he looked at her very fiercely and said, first, take care of yourself. And that made an impression on me.
Nice.
Impression.
I was hiking on Black Mountain on Wednesday, and a guy was running down the mountain as a jogger and said, I just saw a mountain lion. He just left the trail. And I remember Tan Jeff's story about offering metta to the snakes along the walking path. So I offered metta to the mountain lion and had a lovely hike.
So the mountain lion left you alone?
Yes.
Good.
I recently had a baby and... I want so much to give to her, but I realize that a lot of giving to her well is making sure that I take care of myself, that I sleep well and eat somewhat regularly as much as I can. So that really resounds with my experience right now.
Yeah, that's very important for parents to learn, that it has to be a mutual taking care of each other, because if it's only taking care of the child, everything's about the child. It ends up being kind of lopsided, and the child grows up, you know, with funny attitudes.
That's an important thing if you're a caregiver, because some people, my wife passed away almost 5 years ago, but she had a lot of health issues through her life, and a lot of people get into this real sainthood thing, taking care of people, and they forget about themselves. And if you do that, you're going to be useless. You're going to burn out. So it's really important if you're a caregiver to pace yourself and also to figure out time for you to be with yourself or to just get away from it all.
What I appreciate about this story is that it enhances compassion, because it puts whoever is taking care of whom, it's mutual, puts you on the same plane so that you're no different than the person you're taking care of. And maybe that enhances the ability to, you know, feel in your heart what might be felt in their heart and vice versa.
Nice. Yeah.
I'm Betsy. I was going to add that I attend a weekly meeting for Al-Anon for parents, and I remember the first time I walked through the door to that meeting, hearing people say that they were there for them. Now, I had heard your story, the Buddhist story, before, and it appealed to me at one level. But when I heard my community of people say that they were there for themselves, I thought, well, that's just wonderful for you, but I am not here for any reason other than I have someone in my family that's in extremis, and that's why I'm here, to get help for that person. Fortunately, or unfortunately, depending upon my state of mind, I needed to be in that meeting for years. And really, with all the passing time, these lessons go deeper and deeper and deeper. And in a way, it's that, I found at least, it was that searing pain that was that drew me into that room in a choiceless kind of way, like, you've just got to go there, that allowed for the deeper and deeper and deeper appreciation for these teachings. And so keep telling that story.
Nice. So you came to appreciate the people who said they're there for themselves with time. Is that right? Yeah.
Thank you for the quote.
Over some years, as I've looked at my efforts to help people, I've noticed a dangerous spiral of thinking that can happen, that it can start with, if I'm able to help them, that means that at some level I'm more competent or skillful than they are. And so then there can arise a sense of pride in my being able to help. And then where it gets really crazy is that if I can make the situation seem more dangerous than it really is, then it means that I have more merit in helping them. And this can just spiral into a rat hole. Those times that I've been mindful enough to step back a little bit and first see what really needs to be done here. And I usually find that much less is required of me than I might like to think.
Nice. I know there are some people who kind of avoid using the word help or the idea that they're helping. Sometimes they, what are some other alternative words to help? Because help sometimes implies a kind of, some people say this separation you're just talking about. Or you have another alternative word?
Presence.
Mm-hmm. Offer presence.
Support,
maybe.
Bear witness.
Company. Sorry?
Bench sitting.
Porch sitting. Yeah. Yeah.
Being with.
Compassion.
Companionship.
Sorry?
Companionship.
A lot of those answers, work really well for people who don't need something to have happen. They just want, it's really helpful to have a companion or presence and all that. But, sometimes people actually need something. A neighbor needs someone to go shopping because they can't get home. So you're helping your neighbor, or are you helping yourself? Are you just, maybe the word help is not needed. Rather than saying, can I help you? You say, can I do something for you? And maybe just that simple change of language establishes a different kind of relationship. Someone else with some? Yes?
I just started reading a book called Trauma Stewardship. Uh-huh. And it's, this title is kind of scary, but it mentions that people who are environmental activists trying to care for the earth, or people who are caregivers trying to care for someone, in a child or a sick person or an elderly person, and the whole range of people who are trying to care and make this a better place, that there are many of situations where you feel you can respond by, oh, I can't do enough, I just can't do enough, or you feel numb, and you just disengage, or all these different strategies that we have, because we're not aware that when we're around people who are suffering or the planet that's suffering and we're trying to make a difference, that we can easily take that on. And I remember a conversation I had with you once years ago and about empathy, and I said, well, it's feeling the same thing the other person feels. And you said, that's not how we see it. And because if you're around a very depressed person and you start feeling very depressed, that's not going to help either one of you. So I remember that very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I've been very moved by the security guards where I work. A couple of times there have been situations where someone has come into the building and clearly is, you know, I don't know, one of them may be dangerous, the other one I'm not sure what they're going to do. But I happen to be walking in the hallway where the security guard is walking up to the person. And he's completely, he has a goal in mind, he's walking towards the person, but he's completely at ease. I'm very impressed by it. You don't have the feeling he has any kind of, the rest of us are kind of going, but he's just completely at ease and walks up very, very relaxed. It's great to see something like that.
Yeah, and I suppose chances are that it puts the threatening person at more at ease too. They're not,
yeah.
And so they're probably less likely to act out.
Yeah.
So straight back.
It feels a little bit more complicated when the scale gets larger. This is something I've dealt with a lot in the political world, where there are some folks who've made enormous positive political changes, but in their personal lives, their behavior was heinous, for lack of a better phrase. And if we had waited for Ted Kennedy to find close personal goodness, he would not have done as much for 100 million women in the United States. So it's good to say, excuse me, you should work on yourself, but some folks have done enormous good without ever having worked on themselves.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully the two aren't exclusive of each other.
But often they are.
And I think that's one of the very interesting, I don't know what to call it, philosophical, you know, kind of ways of thinking about Buddhism in the West, is that Buddhism does not have historically a very strong social gospel, very strong philosophy for helping in society, getting involved in those kinds of big things. And so in recent decades here in the West, a lot of Buddhists have felt the need or desire to be involved politically, politically or in a variety of ways. It's called social engaged Buddhism. And part of that, people who are on the forefront of that field of social engaged Buddhism are doing a lot of thinking and exploration about how to have personal practice, the personal practice towards personal liberation, occur in the very work of social engagement. So it isn't that you have to go off on retreat to develop the four foundations of mindfulness, to learn how to be freer, learn to develop compassion. But how do you find out how to practice that in the middle of your social engagement? And this, I think, is very exciting, the idea we would bring those two together and not have them apart. So next time there's a Ted Kennedy, I hope that do both.
Last night I turned on the TV expecting that the news would be on. And instead there was a program called What Would You Do? And similar to Candid Camera from years ago, they set up scenarios where they watch how people behave. And last night they had set up a conversation between three women, two of them very thin, and the third one was chubby. They were trying to convince her to take diet pills in a very kind of forceful way and in a public environment where they spoke loudly enough for others to overhear. And the point of it is to watch how people in the restaurant would react. Would they interrupt? Would they? And then the thin women left, and the chubby woman was left there. And did they approach her then? Long and short of it, some of the responses are really heartwarming. How people, when they see something that is dangerous for this woman to be taking diet pills that could be amphetamines, or that they intervene in a kind uh-huh. and gentle way, or sometimes not so kind or gentle, yeah. but feel the urgency to support this person.
Yeah, beautiful. So, hopefully it was mostly positive responses people got.
Well, they all the ones that are shown are yeah. are positive in yeah. some manner. I don't know what percentage yeah. are the other way.
I think it's a little bit complicated sometimes with some of these personal issues. When there should be intervention, when we leave people alone. But I think my impression is, as a society, we don't do near enough to celebrate people for who they are. And there's so many different ways that people can be. And so some people are large, and it should be celebrated. Some people are small, it should be celebrated. Some people are men, they should be celebrated. Some people are women, they should be celebrated. And some people are gender diverse, a whole different, and that's beautiful and wonderful in itself, right? And so let's celebrate this, all the differences. And so I hope someone came up to her in the restaurant and said, you're beautiful.
Many of them did. I mean, it was, they definitely supported her and questioned whether these other women were really, truly her friends.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because the scenarios are a bit over the top. which
they're all actors, right?
Yes, and the crew comes out to tell the people that that similar to Candy Camera, where you're on Candy Camera.
Wow, I don't think Candy Camera would come out of a Buddhist community. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I've spent more than half of the past year in silent retreat, and I've noticed that coming out of these long retreats over and over again, that there's so much reflection of the goodness that's here from really being close to the practice for long periods of time. And I find that sometimes I can take that in and really appreciate it as not even something that is something that I own or that's mine that I did, but just a result of the teachings and them being practiced. And I noticed that the hardest thing for me has been to consistently be able to take that in and use that as a continuing inspiration for practice. And I think that work of really knowing our own goodness and taking that in from others' reflections is really important work.
Nice.
So I work in a renewable energy company, and it can get pretty intense sometimes. And I wasn't sure if I was going to come for the sitting today at 9 a.m. because I had to get a lot of things done for tomorrow. And but oftentimes, I have to decide for myself I'm going to take a break, and otherwise it's I can sense that I'm going to burn out, and I have to at least give somehow that'll make others have an opportunity to to take a break. So it is I think it was the topic was very timely, and but it's something that have to be consciously done over and over again, otherwise it's not a one-time thing.
Yeah, I think so. And I suppose that there's plenty of places nowadays in businesses and startups and where they kind of the push to work all the time, and it turns out that people become less and less efficient. There are some places in Europe, I've heard, where they actually have shorter work days rather than longer, and they find that people actually are more efficient, get more done than this push expectation that's always supposed to work. I saw some hands back there, and then we'll maybe one more, and then we'll stop.
Yeah, I appreciate the talk today because it really hit some things that I wanted to hear and needed to hear. I've been in helping professions all of my life, and I derived a great deal of joy and gratification from that. In fact, when I retired, I immediately looked for volunteer opportunities so that I could give. But I also realized only then that there was a tipping that I needed to find the joy of taking care of myself. And I've made a beginning by nice. Coming here.
Nice. So, thank you. So I'd like to say, I'd like to have the last word, if I may. So, the Buddha says, you know, the one way to take care of others is to practice the four foundations of mindfulness, practice mindfulness in a deep way. And one of the benefits that can come from deep inner practice, contemplative practice, is to discover your own beauty, discover some real value, to be really settled and at home in yourself in a wonderful way, in a precious way. And from that, doing that, you have different eyes in which to see other people. And it's easier to appreciate others then as well. So if you can really appreciate something in your own heart as being some of those valuable things that you have, the treasure that you have inside, if you can find that treasure, then you're able to see the treasure of others, how wonderful and special others are. And no matter who they are, you know, that everyone should be celebrated. Great, so enjoy. Thank you.